Chapter 4, it's multi-degree of freedom vibration. So far, we've really looked at just one degree of freedom oscillation. We've modeled a couple of multi-degree of freedom systems in Chapter 1, but didn't really look at responses or anything like that, right? So we're going to take, and what we'll see is that in if we have multiple degrees of freedom of vibration we care about, a lot of the things, or pretty much everything we learned, has analogies in this case. Right. We have multiple degrees of freedom. We have not just one natural frequency. We have N natural frequencies, where N is the number of degrees of freedom. We don't just have one damping ratio. We have N different damping ratios, one for each mode of oscillation. And what we'll see is that the way to get to what those parameters are really matches what we did in single degree of freedom as well. Okay. So I'm going to start. We'll start without damping like we did before. We'll kind of follow the same outline of introducing concepts. We'll just do them for multi-degree of freedom. Most of the examples will work will be 2 degrees of freedom. It's kind of what we can do in a lecture setting because the math gets kind of long. But it just extends out. And you'll see, we'll get to it today, one thing that makes the math really easy to extend out. Okay. So let's look at a 2-degree of freedom system first. So let's say I have M1. And it's on a frictionless surface. I have M2 on that same frictionless surface. And let's connect everything up with springs. So I have K1 that connects M1 to ground. I'm going to have K2 between M1 and M2, and K3. Connects M2 to ground. And we'll describe the position of these guys from equilibrium, x1 and x2. And right now, we won't say, you know, there's no forces acting on this guy. We'll look basically at free vibration responses, initial condition responses to start. Okay, so if I'm going to figure out how this thing vibrates, where do you think we start? Equations of motion, which means we start with free body diagram. Correct. Okay. I have 2 bodies. What kind of forces do we have? Spring forces. Start over here maybe with K1. For spring 1, I guess. Of course, we have gravity and normal force acting on that guy, which, like we've been doing until this point, we're saying they balance. We're only worried about X motion. And we have the same ones over in M2 for that guy, at least. Okay. Force of spring 3. We have that spring in the middle. I'm going to draw this way. I'm going to hold M2. And if I kind of had push on X1, that's how I'm going to draw my arrows. Right? So I know that happens. If they're squeezed together, let's say, right, the spring is going to be pushing this way on X1 and that way on X2. All right. Anything else? That's it, I think. So let's write our equation of motion then. Well, M1, X1, double dot. As the sum of the forces, and I'll just subscript it with X1 because it's the sum of the forces acting on X1. What do we have there? Well, again, we get rid of the y. Minus the first spring force, minus the second spring force. We look at M2. What forces are acting on M2? Circuit string force is positive now. And that third spring's negative. Okay, now we need to figure out what are the magnitude of those terms, right? What's the fourth spring, first spring force? Yep, K1, X1. That one's easy. What's the third one? Yep. That one's easy too. And this one's not hard, but so it's going to have some K2. What order do those terms need to come in here? X2 minus X1. X2 minus X1, no. That's not right. Why is that not right? Right, so if I hold this, right, I know the arrow on M1 is this way. Right, if I held X2 and moved X1, so X1's bigger than X2, this guy's pointing that way. That's right. Yeah.
So if you held M1 and moved M2 to the left, shouldn't spring 3 be pointing the other way?
No. Spring 3 is always trying to push X2 back to its equilibrium of 0. This is x1 minus x2. x1 is greater than x2. The magnitude of that is positive, but the arrow gives us the negative sign. So we have and that's kind of how I knew that this order was wrong when we said x2 minus x1. Right. I knew that this should be stable, and if I had x2 minus x1, I get a minus sign when I pull it over the other term, and it's an unstable equation. Okay, so I have two equations of motion, which is right because I have 2 degrees of freedom, right? Let's bring all the x1 and x2 terms over to the left-hand side of the equation. And I'll group them as well. That's X1. Okay, so we have two equations of motion, and we should have that. We have 2 degree of freedom system. Okay, these look like what you would expect coming from a 1 degree of freedom world so far. We got masses and springs. Look like something you'd expect. Yeah. Okay. So what I'm going to say is, hey, what I want to be able to do, and what will matter when we get beyond 2 or 3 degrees of freedom, is to be able to write this system of equations in matrix form. How many of you guys have been through linear algebra, by the way? Probably not many, right? Okay. So I want to take, I have two states of my system. I have x1 and x2 that I care about. What I want to be able to write is something like this. Where m and k are matrices, and x is kind of this vector of coordinates. Okay. So for us, that x then is that. Now I need to figure out what do I need to be in m and k in order for my two equations of motion, in this case, to fit into this matrix form of the system of differential equations. Okay, so let's do that. I know I'm going to have some matrix there. If I take two derivatives of that kind of coordinate vector, it just ends up being that, right? I know I'm going to have some matrix, and it's going to multiply these guys. And I'm going to have zeros on both sides of that guy over there. Okay, so if I look at my first equation, right, that's just basically going to be the first row of this matrix form, right? Well, I have m1 times x1 double dot plus 0 times x2, right? Okay. And I have k1 plus k2 times x1 minus k2 times x2 equals 0. Okay. And I can do the same thing for the second equation. Well, I have 0 times m1. It's m2 times x2 double dot. Right. I have a minus k2 times x1, and then k2 plus k3 times x2 all equal 0. And then we know this is my M matrix. Right. We call this guy the mass or inertia matrix. Right. Most generally the inertia matrix, because you could have moments or even products of inertia in this matrix for larger systems. Okay. We generally call this K matrix. We'll be called the stiffness matrix. So it'll be strings, any kind of restoring forces, conservative restoring forces end up in that matrix. Gravity terms end up in that matrix, for example. They have inertial and stiffness, these two matrices, M and K. Okay. This equation look familiar? Generally, right? It's just like a mass spring system. I'm just writing a matrix form of it. Okay. So in that case, how do you think we might solve this system of differential equations, given its similarity to what we got here? Assume some kind of solution, right? I'm going to assume a solution of that form. Okay. If I plug that into the matrix form of this equation, I get that. And then, well, I can just divide by that and it goes away, since it's in all terms. So I get, in this case, for that, trying to figure out what x bar is, right? Just like we were in the single degree freedom case. I need to know those coefficients. Well, how do I get to this solution? What is one obvious solution? X bar is 0. Yeah, that's an answer here. It doesn't move forever. Yeah, that's not a very interesting answer. Okay. How else could I get to an answer? Multiply by the inverse. Okay. So if I did, you're telling me I want to do this. What's that? What's that right-hand side? 0. So I still get back to x bar is 0. So if k minus omega squared has an inverse, we just get to X bar having a zero, being zero. So what our solution needs, what we need for this case not to happen, for us to actually get to an oscillatory solution, is for this term to not have an inverse. We need k minus omega squared m to not have an inverse. Anybody recognize what kind of problem this is? It's a family of problems that follow this form. It's an eigenvalue problem. Okay, so if we have some matrix, right? We have some matrix, in this case, k minus omega squared m, or it would be true for any matrix, really. What does it mean for the inverse to not exist? What kind of conditions hold? Determinant's equal to zero, right? So that's going to be what we want. Okay. What does that mean in terms of the kind of what that matrix looks like, if you will? It has something to do with the linear independence of the matrix. It's got to be a square matrix, yeah. We got squares all the way through.
Right. One row could equal another row.
Right, so all the rows have to be linearly independent. Right. It has to be a full rank matrix. Okay. So, we're going to take that determinant. Let's just start by doing that for our particular example matrix, and we'll see kind of where this ends up. So let's write out k minus omega squared m first, maybe. So I got play 1 plus k2. So that's k minus omega squared m, right? And I want to take the determinant of that. How do I take the determinant of a square 2 by 2 matrix? That. Okay. So for us, if we take the determinant of this guy, I'm going to set that equal to zero. We end up with just that. Okay. Anybody know what this equation is called? Well, let's start, actually, before with the equation, let's start with just that polynomial. Is what that's called? Is that? Not quite. This is the characteristic polynomial. And we'll see why it's called that soon. So then what do you think the equation's called? Yeah, characteristic equation. Okay. When you're solving for the roots or poles in controls class, you're solving this equation for that transfer function. So the denominator of a transfer function is its characteristic polynomial. When you're solving for that, you're getting to the poles. The roots of that equation are the poles of the system. So given that, what do you think this equation tells us about the system? Its solution. I know the poles. Yeah, I get the poles of this guy. What do the poles tell us about the system? Tells us a lot, right? Yeah, I can know about stability. I can know about what the response looks like. Remember we did that pole zero map where I plot the poles on that pole zero map. I can know damping ratio and natural frequency and everything I need to know. Right? So solving this equation gives me the characteristics of this system. Okay. So there's our polynomial equation. Characteristics of polynomial. And characteristic equation. Okay. Let's take this guy. Let's see. I'll come back right here. Get rid of that for now. That'll work for now. Let's look at, you know, this is kind of abstract right now. Let's look at some parameters for this particular system. Let's say that M1 and M2 are equal. In this case, we'll plug in some numbers to match how the book introduces this. Say M1 and M2 are equal, and K1, K2, K3 are all equal. So just given that, okay, if I had some initial conditions of the system, let's talk through what we might expect the response to look like for some initial conditions given this set of parameters. And we'll see why the math supports that, hopefully. Okay. If I took those guys, I have M1 equals M2, and then all three of my springs are equal. Okay. If I took these guys, M1 and M2, and displaced them over exactly the same amount, and let them go, what's the response look like? Stay the same distance apart. Right. So everybody follow that? So I took M1, M2, and I displaced them over a little bit, exactly equally, and let them go. They stay exactly in phase. Why? Can be treated as a solid entity. No, because we'll see that we have another response that's not that. How much? Yeah, basically, right? So in that case, right, if x1 minus x2 is 0, there's no force there. Right? And then if k1 and k2 are equal, well, the spring forces are equal. The k4 spring 1 and 4 spring 3. So for all time, they have exactly, and they have the same mass. So the F side of the equation is the same, the M is the same, so the X dot part of the acceleration part of the equation is the same. Right. So they move exactly together. What if I did, I took these guys and I moved them exactly opposite of one another and let go? What's going to happen? Yeah, they're going to be exactly out of phase. Why? What's that? Was that just right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, that's right. Right. So they're exact. If I have this, right, these kind of outer spring forces are the same, but these guys are opposite sign. Right. So it's pulling on them. That middle spring force is what's driving the oscillation back and forth. What if I just displace M1? So I hold M2 where it's at, and I just displace this guy over and let him go. What do we get? Can you say anything about that case?
You're holding M2 still?
I'm going to hold M2 still. I'm going to displace M1 over a little bit and then let them both go at the same time. That's right. So we get some oscillation where M1 and M2 are not exactly either one of the cases that we just found. What's going to be kind of cool about this is that it's a linear combination of those two cases we just found. Okay. So it has some component of it that is them moving out exactly in phase, that response, plus some component of them moving exactly out of phase. And adding those up in the right way gets me to the general response. Okay. So those two shapes we talked about, those two excitations we talked about, are really important for the system. Because I can write any response to this system as a linear combination of those two responses. That all comes from this. So let's look at that in more detail. If I do this, okay, and I solve this guy for omega squared, the trick here is to solve for omega squared, not omega. Because you're going to get a quadratic equation there, and I'll go ahead and write it out. Quadratic equation and omega squared. So I can solve 1 2 squared. Right, well, I might as well just do it. All right, just that, and we get that omega 1 squared. We get those two solutions for omega squared. Given what class we're in, what do you think these guys represent? Everything we've said so far. Natural frequencies. Right. So these are the square of the natural frequencies of that system. That's where we got omega squared. We have two degrees of freedom. We have two natural frequencies. Okay. In terms of the eigenvalue problem, these are the eigenvalues. Okay. We typically label these frequencies when you have multi-degree of freedom from the lowest frequency being the lowest number. So you'll go omega 1, omega 2 in order of increasing frequency. Okay. So, for our system we're talking about now. Let's get to the next page. Which of the two? Yes, sir. We're getting to that right now. Of the two ways this system vibrates kind of naturally, which one corresponds to which of those frequencies, intuitively, do you think? So he said omega 1 goes to M1. No, that's not right, actually. That's a really common mistake, and I don't mean to pick on you. But these frequencies describe the entire system. You know, oscillation of the entire system, not just a single mass. Okay? So the entire system, when it's oscillating at this natural frequency, the entire system is moving at that frequency, not just a single degree of freedom. Same thing for the higher one. So of the two, we talked about kind of two ways, two shapes, mode shapes, we're going to see they're called, of how this system oscillates. He said, hey, there's one natural way it kind of moves it exactly back and forth. There's one natural way it kind of moves back and forth this way, opposite of one another. So we have two mode shapes that we kind of intuitively discovered for this system. And we have two natural frequencies. We need to match a natural frequency to one of those mode shapes. Which one of those do you think has lower frequency? When they're together. Why? You can kind of think about it, there's more mass that's moving together. Right? If we thought about this as a single degree of freedom, what do we need for the frequency to be lower? We need either kind of smaller k or bigger m. we think about this, and if they're moving exactly together, it's kind of acting like there's a bigger M there, because they're moving exactly together. But then also the kind of effective K term, restoring force, is also smaller. Because this guy's not being deflected at all. He's not contributing anything. Right? So we can kind of think, hey, well, when they're moving exactly together, they should oscillate at this frequency. And they're exactly back and forth at 2 radians a second. When they're moving exactly opposite of one another, right, they should be oscillating at square root of 12 radians a second, back and forth. Okay. Those are eigenvalues. We also have a concept of a thing called eigenvectors. Now, eigenvectors are a way to get to, you have some complex case here, or the case where all these things are not equal. It's not as easy to reason about what those natural shapes are going to look like. Eigenvectors get us to that representation. Okay. To find the eigenvector, okay, we take each one of our eigenvalues. This. So this eigenvalues give us our natural frequencies. So eigenvector solution. You're going to give us what are called the mode shapes. Right? And that's kind of the natural shape. Like the natural frequency gives us a natural frequency that it oscillates at. Mode shapes give us a natural kind of shape that it oscillates at. So in our case, in this case, there's one where they're exactly together, one where they're exactly opposite. Those are the mode shapes. Okay. To solve the eigenvectors, you take each one of your eigenvalues. So let's look at the first one. Omega 1 squared equals 4. And you plug that back into x bar, that equation, the k minus omega squared x bar equation. And in this case, that omega squared, you plug in your first eigenvalue for that. So it becomes omega 1 squared. So we would have ended up, there's k end up with an equation that looks like that. Set of equations. And this guy's just 4, so we end up with 4 that being true. Okay. And what we're looking for, we need to solve this system of equations for x1 and x2. So we have 2 equations, right? Are those unique equations? Are those 2 equations linearly independent? No. Right. They shouldn't be, because that's what we plugged in for them. We said we're picking omega 1, picking our eigenvalues so that k minus omega squared m is not full rank. It's determinant 0. So we should get repeating a set of the equations that are linearly dependent. So only one of these really matters to us. And we could pick whichever one would be easier to solve in the particular case. For us, it doesn't really matter, right? In our case, this whole family of equations is solved when x1 is equal to x2. Right? So we get that solution. That becomes what we can say, match my kind of x1. It's our first eigenvector, or our first mode shape. It's 1, 1. Well, that means for our response that the magnitude of x1 always equals the magnitude of x2. So the math there matches what our intuition told us about how that would be vibrating at that frequency. If we do the same thing, let's skip the matrix math. It's in the notes for you. We end up for that as an eigenvector or mode shape for the second eigenvalue. So we have eigenvalue, eigenvector pairs. They always go together. So our first eigenvalue, eigenvector pair, omega 1 squared is 4 radians squared per second, eigenvector 1, 1. Okay. 12 radians per second squared, eigenvector 1 minus 1. So that 1 minus 1 means they're always moving in exactly opposite magnitude to one another. That matches what we kind of our intuition told us as well. Okay. The general solution, however, those are only two kind of special solutions. What we see is the general solution is a linear combination of those two. Okay. So we're going to have a case where we assume some kind of form for x of t, it went away. Come back over here for right now. Okay. We assume that kind of x of t was some kind of capital bar e to the capital x e to the omega t, right? Well, we find out, well, we have two kind of solutions that work for that guy. So we do just like we did for the single degree of freedom case, right, where we had the mixed sines and cosines. We had to mix the two solutions. So we might write, let me match my notation here. Okay. Missing a step. Okay. So for this first solution, given my first eigenvector, okay, when you look at what, how do we write the time equation to describe this response? Right. Well, if I look at this guy, right, I kind of have plus or minus omega 1. Still satisfies that, right? So I end up with an x of t that looks like that. So I have to consider both of those components of the solution. I could also write this as that. Just like we did for a single degree of freedom case, I can write combinations of sines and cosines, which is really what this is. Right. Or I can write some kind of phase magnitude phase magnitude form. Okay. And sorry. That could be a plus. You'll see it be a minus. Doesn't matter really. And I could do the same thing for x2. Right. So this is kind of x of t in that first mode, the first mode's component to the total response. Right. I can do x2. The kind of second component of the response follows the same form. You just plug in the second mode shape and second eigenvalue. Mm-hmm. Right. Or you could write it in magnitude and phase form if you want to do it as well. So then what we see is the total solution just a combination of those. Right? So what we saw in the general case, We have those two modes of oscillation, right? The two natural ways it wants to oscillate. Well, if it's not exactly matching those, then it's some combination of those two natural ways that it's going to move. Okay, so the total x of t ends up being just a combination of those two kind of natural responses, if you will. Okay. So we figured out the total response in the general case is that. It's some linear combination of those two natural, those two mode shapes. Right? And we said, hey, the harmonic component of that's just those two natural frequencies, our eigenvalues. How do we figure out B1 on B1, phi1, B2, phi2? What's that? Initial conditions, right? So in this case, what you're going to have, you're going to have initial conditions for every coordinate that you care about, right? So you're going to have an x1 at time 0, an x1 dot at time 0, x2 at time 0, x2 dot at time 0. You'd be given those. You take this equation and solve to satisfy those initial conditions. And that gives you B1, B2, phi1, phi2. Okay. So we'll walk over it. There's, yes.
So whenever you plot this in like the frequency domain, how do you know which is the major natural frequency versus like a minor natural frequency?
What do you mean by major or minor?
Where, like, it's the major, like, the larger curve. Okay. Just
hang on to that for a little bit. Just hang on to that for a little bit. Okay. I was going to say the solution, an example of plugging exponential conditions is in the notes, but I want to make one more general point, summarize the general point before we run out of time. Okay. So let's walk through this one more time. So I'm going to figure out, we figured out how to find natural frequency and damping ratio for one degree of freedom system. We're starting down that path for multi-degree of freedom systems. Right? We can't just take this guy, much as we'd like to, and just divide by m and get some kind of multi-degree freedom natural frequency. Matrices don't quite work that way. Right? So what we do instead to figure out what our natural frequencies are solve this eigenvalue problem for k minus omega squared m. In this case. And that's going to give us n eigenvalues, for where n is the number of degrees of freedom we have. So we got a 3-degree of freedom system. We had another mass and some springs. These are 3x3 matrices. Right? If you're solving an FEA problem and you got thousands of masses and little springs all together, this is a 1,000x1,000 matrix. And I can do this exact same procedure and get natural frequencies and damping ratios. And that's, in fact, what FEA is doing, largely. Okay. So I take and I get n eigenvalues, the square root of which represents the natural frequency for each mode of oscillation. Okay. So those kind of natural ways we're talking about things oscillating, those are what we call modes. Okay. So we have a natural frequency for each mode. It's determined by the eigenvalues, solving the eigenvalue problem. For each eigenvalue, there's an associated eigenvector, which we get by plugging the eigenvalue back into the solution, solving for what x needs to be. But eigenvector tells us the mode shape. That's what we call it. What is the kind of shape of that oscillation at that natural frequency? And for this selection of parameters for this system, we saw they were 1, 1, and 1, minus 1. Okay. So we figured out how to get natural frequency for multi-degree of freedom systems. And also get those mode shapes. How does it naturally want to oscillate? And then, kind of looking at the math, well, we see that any generic response is just a linear combination of those mode shapes. Okay? Let's talk about one more point. If we have, just think about this, if we have initial conditions that exactly match a mode shape. Which mode gets excited? Which mode dominates the response? Can I go on full circle for you? I have initial conditions. X1 of 0, X2 of 0 is 2, 2. Both of them are 2. And I let go after that. Only that mode gets excited. All that happened, all the response after that is them moving exactly the same amount. Right? Well, that's just the first mode. Nothing from that second mode shows up in that response then. Okay? If I had X1 dot equals 2 and X2 dot equals at 0 equals 2, so they're going the same speed, which mode gets excited? Just the first mode. My initial conditions exactly matched a mode shape. So only that mode got excited. One sec. Okay? If I had the same thing, so if I had 2 minus 2, and let them go. Only the second mode gets excited.
Yeah. So you couldn't plot the time response unless you knew which mode the system is. Like you're going to plot the time response for this system.
Yeah. So if you were going to plot the time response, you can do that quickly. And I said, well, X1, X2 both equal X0. Well, what does the response look like? They both just move together, right? So you end up with both of them just being that. Right. So that's maybe X1 they're both the same. If they're exactly opposite, right? I had X1's X0, X2 was excited to minus X0. Well, I know they're going to say exactly opposite for all time. There I have the time response for all the cases we just looked at. Okay. One more case to look at in our last 2 minutes. Sorry. If I had initial conditions that don't exactly match a mode shape, if I went 2 and 0.2, what happens here? I get some combination of both of these. If I went 2 and 1.999999, which mode do you think dominates the response? Yeah, the first mode dominates the response. I'm basically exactly matching that mode shape. Right? If I went 1 and minus 0.999999, same thing happens here. I get that second mode is the dominant mode of oscillation there. Okay. But in that case, there will be some contribution of the whole thing kind of moving back and forth a little bit. Or in the one we talked about before that, even though almost exactly, there will be some where they're vibrating back and forth. Due to the excitation. We're going to talk a lot more about this on Tuesday.